Today's topic is a really important one for me because I really struggled with shyness when I was younger. I remember in high school I started realizing that other people seemed to just be fine having conversations with people, and I was really awkward about it, and it was just a struggle for me, and I started feeling like, okay, am I just a weirdo or what? And I would just try everything I could think of to be more outgoing and talk with people, and it always was a struggle. Anyone else? Or am I the only one? Okay, there's a couple people. But I just finally resigned that I'm probably not going to be able to change myself, and I'll just kind of be more of a loner kind of person. And then I joined a home church, and I started learning how to love other people and how to serve other people and really have a genuine interest in their life and focus on them. And I realized after several years of trying to do that, just trying to love people with God's love, just being concerned about people and interested in their life, that as a side benefit, something started happening that it was taking away my shyness. It kind of shocked me. It was like God's backward wisdom. He helped cure that by me just kind of taking a focus off myself and being interested in other people. And I was so thankful for that, to just be released from that awkwardness of conversation that I used to have. But I'll never forget the day my seventh grade son calls from school, and he'd had several times where he kept calling me from school because he was sick. So this day we're in the car, and he started unloading how he struggled with relationships and feeling so awkward with school, and I just broke down crying because it was like listening to myself talk. There he was, exactly what I felt. And I was so shocked because I thought I had overcome that before I had him. So I thought, how did he learn this? And I realized, you know, he inherited it from me. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. You know, you got this right from me. But fortunately, I could say, you got this honestly from me. But this is how God has helped me learn to overcome it. And you don't have to live like this your whole life. There are ways God can help you overcome it. So I can help. Hopefully, he'll get it faster than I did. So I'm thankful for this topic. Rosie Talarczyk's here to share about the art of conversation. Rosie is not a shy person, so she doesn't struggle with that, so it's good to balance, have someone that just that comes naturally, and how she's offered up that gift to God to be used as a ministry. So I'm excited to hear what she has to share. She's been in Xenos since the mid-70s. She met Martha McCallum way back when she was doing the Layman's Challenge groups. So she's been around for a long time, and she's home church leader. She's got 3 kids and 6 grandchildren. And so we're excited to have her today. So come on up, Rosie.
Good morning. I am not normally standing in front of people so spread out, but it doesn't bother me at all. So I'm just going to talk to you guys back there as well as to people sitting up close. About developing the art of conversation. If we think about what a conversation is, it's a spoken exchange of thoughts, opinions, and feelings, or simply a talk. And when I looked this up, I thought I should probably look this up just to be sure I know what I'm actually talking about, which normally doesn't bother me, but when I've been assigned a topic, I want to be on task. And the third definition had to do with a real-time conversation through a computer. And I'm going to scratch that one off our list today, because we're not going to talk about any kind of tech conversations with texts over iPhones or with computer chats or anything else. We're just going to talk about conversations with people face-to-face, not through computers. And the reason we want to talk about conversations is because it's a goal to have of everybody in the world, every human being, to have intimate relationships. And the only way we can have intimate relationships is to share ourselves in conversation. And we want to have these intimate relationships as moms with our kids, because this is what a mom really desires, is to know her children and to know that her children have a knowledge of her love for them. So that's a goal that we're going to look at as we go through this. But stating that we have this goal of looking at conversations toward developing intimacy, I want to state right up front that this is not a science. There's a reason why the title of this is The Art of Conversation. There is not a formula for having conversations. And whether you're a shy person or whether you're an outgoing person, there's no real way that you can just hone this down and make it into a product that you can produce with your children. It's an art, it's a practice, it's a skill that needs to be developed. There's no right or wrong way to do this. It's trial and error mainly. And I want to emphasize that a conversation with your child or with anybody else is different from a teaching. It's different from a guidance session. It's different from a time of discipline. A conversation might be any of those things, but a conversation is the exchange. And normally in a teaching or a time of discipline, it's a one-way kind of thing. I'm the parent, you're the child. This is what you're going to do, or this is what has to happen, or this is what the consequence is. And what we're talking about with conversation is that we're going to take that one way down, and we're going to put up a two-way exchange going on. Conversations do not compete with function, but they enable function. And I want us to think about that in something that you might be experiencing about bedtime, where it might be the goal to get the kid into bed and asleep and quiet. And that might be the time that the child says, I want to talk to you about something. They might not use those words, but they might draw you into a conversation. And as a tired mom, you might be thinking, no, I just want this child to go to bed. I just want there to be quiet in my house. I want to sit down with my whatever I want to do. I want to sit down and be an adult. And yet that could be the moment. That could be the 5 or 10 minutes that would give you what you really want, a step toward intimacy with your child. And it would also enable that child probably to go to bed, go to sleep, knowing they've been heard. What greater accomplishment could you have in your day than to put your child to bed knowing they've been heard? So even though it may feel like the kid is winning on some part of that, you're being able to win too, and that you are getting something you really want as far as a conversation. And this works all the way across the board, not just with bedtime with toddlers. This works with car time with teens, and it works with middle kids as they are just claiming some time and asking for that little bit of conversation. So I want to give you 3 disclaimers that before we start and get into my outline. I want to say that I did not do this well all the time, nor did my family do this well all the time with conversations. We did have fights. We did have discipline sessions that were very one-sided. And we didn't always fail to really show respect in our conversations. Or we did sometimes fail to show respect. Sometimes I was too tired, too distracted, too busy, too selfish, or too impatient to have a conversation. And I parented in the pre-tech era, so I wasn't competing with all the gizmos that kids carry around now. On the other hand, this kind of withdrawing from my kids, sometimes I pushed too hard. And I drove a wedge between myself and my kids with my need to know what was going on in their lives. And I was impatient, and I destroyed something I really wanted by pushing too hard to find out what I wanted out of the conversation. My second disclaimer is that conversations are not an insurance policy. I have 3 children, about as different as they could be. I was involved in calls from school, trips to the office, several court appearances, more trips to the police station, 5 weddings for 3 kids, which means there were 2 divorces in there. I've had numerous car wrecks with my kids, sometimes physical car wrecks and sometimes emotional car wrecks to get through. And several stints in rehab with one of my kids and many embarrassing moments. I've had lots of opportunity for lots of different kinds of conversation. And I can tell you, I have experienced some of the strangest conversations in some of the strangest places that have been the most rewarding conversations. So we don't always get to pick and choose what the times are. All 3 of my kids survived the death of my husband with me and their father, and we were transformed in that process through some of these great conversations that we had. I have now 3 young families to enjoy as they walk with the Lord, and 6 grandkids, as you heard. So I have 2 boy grandchildren and 4 girl grandchildren. My daughter said, be sure you talk about boys. So we're going to get to boys at the end. And my third disclaimer is learning to have a close relationship with your kids is much more manageable within the framework of the body of Christ or within the framework of a Christian fellowship, and I recommend it. I found lots of support through my community of faith. I found lots of support for my kids as they went through Sunday school programs and home churches themselves. But the disclaimer is we cannot turn our children's conversations and that intimacy and relationships over to any of these people, even a great grandparent or a wonderful godmother. This is your privileged position as a parent to have these conversations with your kids, and it's really worth the investment, worth risks. So given those three disclaimers, we're going to start going through the outline on the first page, and then we'll have time at the end for some discussion about anything that comes up. So just make a mark, and we'll come back to any questions that might come up. First of all, as I said, relationships is what we really all desire with our children, and we want close relationships. And so we're going to look this morning at conversations as a tool for those close relationships. And as Christians, we recognize that we have a vertical relationship and a horizontal relationship. And this vertical relationship is what we're going to use this morning as a model for what our horizontal relationships are. We're going to look at how God relates to us, and then we're going to transfer that into how we can learn to relate within our relationships, particularly with our children. With God, we know that we can pray. And the Bible has terrific models of prayer. These are conversations with God. And I referenced one there, Psalm 116, 1 through 2, as an illustration of one of the prayers that is just beautiful. And it's from Psalm, and it says, I love the Lord, for he heard my voice. He heard my cry for mercy. Because he turned his ear to me, I will call on him as long as I live. And this is such a great illustration because it involves someone talking, someone listening, and the intimacy that's developed, this ongoing commitment. As long as I live, I'm going to call on your name. Wouldn't we as parents be thrilled if that's what our kids said to us? I called out to you, you heard me, and I'm going to keep coming back to you. So that's one element, one illustration of a great conversation. And we know that we can have those great conversations with God, and we also know that we want these great conversations with friends and with people. And who are your best friends? Who are the people you want to have conversations with? Who are the people you trust in conversations? Aren't they the people who really listen to you, who are available to you, that you want to keep coming back to, and you want to keep sharing your life with and collecting information about their lives from them? It's because we have this exchange. We speak, they listen. They speak, we listen. And then the goal, this idea of intimacy, I want to hit on this just for a second, this idea of to know and be fully known. God talks about this throughout the Bible. This is God's goal with us. He wants us to know him, and he wants us to know that we are fully known by him. And that's a phrase right out of 1 Corinthians 13:12. And in Genesis 2:25, there's a reference to Adam and Eve, that they were naked and unafraid with each other. Some Bibles say unashamed. And they were naked and unashamed with each other, and they were naked and unashamed before God. They had great relationships in this period of time before everything fell apart. And that's our goal. That's what we want to go for. This idea of to know and be fully known, the word has its root word goes back to the idea of sexual intercourse. And it's the idea of that intimacy, that knowing somebody and being completely connected with somebody. And it's not odd that God uses that, because he uses the illustration of marriage all the way through the Bible for the closeness that he wants to have with us. And it's to be a model of what we're going for in that kind of connectedness that we feel in the best idea of marriage. And so he calls the church his bride, and he says that Jesus is the bridegroom. It's a model all the way through the Bible. Another model that God uses in this knowing and being known idea is the idea of a parent and child. And he uses this model for us. We are the children and he is the parent. And I put down a reference there to Romans 8 when Paul says, "You have received the spirit of sonship, and by him we cry out, Abba, Father." And the word could be translated Papa or Daddy. It's an intimate father and child relationship that God wants with us, and that once he has that with us, he shows us how to have that with our children and with our friends. God uses the illustration to be at home with us or to abide with us. And that's what we want with our children, to have that kind of security in the relationship. And how do we measure success in relationships? How do we measure success with conversation? And I want to propose that we measure success because we have an ongoing commitment to this exchange, and that we see that we keep coming back and that they keep coming back. When your children are little, they have to come to you. They're dependent on you. They need you. They don't have food without you. They don't have a house without you. They don't have clothes without you. As they get older, you want your children to keep coming back to you for these conversations. Some of you don't have older children, but think about your relationship with your parents. Are you able to keep going back to them? Or who do you keep going back to for guidance or input? This is what the goal is of success in a conversation. So I'm going to just use 3 points here as we continue to think about the Bible's idea of relationships. One is a key word that's with. This seems like, when I looked around, when I looked through the Bible, this idea of God with us is everywhere in the Bible. God with us. And I'm going to, I'm just wrote down that it's an invitation and it's an expression of availability for relational intimacy. But I'm going to give you an illustration from Mark. I taught in my home church, I teach, and I taught last month on Mark 6. And it was the account of Jesus sending his 12 best guys out. And I thought, how is it that these 12 guys got equipped to go out in such a short time? They hadn't been with Jesus that long. So I went back and I read earlier, back again in the beginning of Mark, and I found out in Mark 3, when Jesus particularly selects these 12 guys out of all the people that were hanging out with him, it says Jesus appointed the 12 apostles that they might be with him and then go out. And I thought about that, and I've always skipped over the with him part. I've always gone to, well, he selected these 12 guys because he was going to send them out. No, he selected the 12 guys, first of all, to be with him. And I think that's what God gives us the privilege as parents to have. He gives us our children so that we can be with them. We're not producing a product. We're not producing a rocket scientist. We're not producing a doctor. We're not producing a college graduate. God gives us our children to be with them. And as we look through the whole Bible, that's God's goal, to be with us. He's not concerned about what function we're going to have. He's really concerned about being with us. And he gives an emotional investment. If you read through the accounts of Jesus' relationship with his disciples, he gives them a high emotional investment. And out of that, they function. And the good news was, when I was reading back through the account of these 12 guys, after Jesus sent them out, they came back. Don't we want our kids to come back? What did they come back to? They came back to be with Jesus some more. And there's no account in that first sending out of how many people they talked to, of what they talked about. It says they went out, they talked to people, and they healed some people, but they came back. And in a later account, the disciples come back with joy. They come back joyously, it says. And Jesus says to them, and they're all happy because they did do this. They functioned really well. They talked to a lot of people, and they healed a lot of people. And Jesus says, don't be happy that you did all that. What did he tell them to be happy about? He said, be happy that you have your name written in the book of life, and you'll be with me forever. With is a really key part of intimacy and relationships and conversations. You can't have that kind of conversation, the intimacy that we want, without the with part. It's ongoing. What does this look like with our children? Well, I'm going to give an illustration not with one of my parents, but with a woman who was really key to, in my life when I was in middle school, and her name's Margaret. And she made time for me. She was available to me. She had conversations with me. My mom is dead, but I, in the last 2 years, have called Margaret at least once a week. We email each other all the time because she's been able to give me some input on something that I've really been struggling with. And in key parts of my life, I've gone to Margaret. When our son was into a terrible position with alcohol and terrible rebellion, I called Margaret. And she said, pray that you live to see him turn around in your lifetime. And we did. And my husband, before he died, got to see our son turn around. It was the best advice. It took the pressure off. In my lifetime, could I wait? Could I be patient for God? Another time when my husband was dying, he said, how are you going to figure this piece out? And I said, I'll call Margaret. I'll go see Margaret. And I did. I parked myself at her house. I slept. I listened to her make coffee in the morning while I was in bed. And I thought, this is with, when I thought of an illustration. This is what it means to be with your children. You make time for them. You give them a priority for conversations and exchanges. And in the long run, you'll have a lifetime of conversations with your children. The second point I want to make is on the outline there, is that I want us to think about having a confident vision for a hope and a future for our children. And again, we're not talking about academic success. I hope you pass into third grade this year because you're sure not doing a great job. Or I hope that you finish that paper you need to write for your college application so you can get into college. Or I hope that you turn out to get this relationship straightened out so that you don't end up being a, you know, slug as an adult. That's not the hope we're talking about. We're talking about real character issues, real character, deep character traits. And I've got three illustrations there for you. The first one is God was really big on giving people new names. And he saw people, and he saw something really valuable in people. And he would change their name accordingly. And the one that I've got there for you to think about is Peter. And Simon, what originally his name was Simon, and he was not the most trustworthy of the 12 guys that Jesus hung out with. He was kind of somebody that would stick his foot in his mouth. He was not reliable. He would say he would do something and didn't do it. And the one example then that we have here in John is Jesus looked at Peter, this unreliable, kind of wild guy. And he said, I'm going to change your name. I'm going to call you Cephas, which means rock, when we translate to Peter. And he says, I see something in you. Other people don't see it, maybe, but I see it. And I'm going to count on you. And Jesus did. A second illustration there is from in Joshua, and where there was a task in front of Joshua. It was a huge task. And he was going to take on the task of leading the people into the land against great odds. And so this was a monumental thing in front of Joshua. And how is it that God expressed a confident vision to Joshua? He says in Joshua 1, 5, and 9, it's a great passage. If you have time, go back and look at it later. He says, God's speaking, as I was with Moses, I will be with you. Be strong and courageous. And in that passage, he says that phrase three times. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. And again, that idea of with, and the idea that there he can pick up this strength and this courage from that knowing that God will be with him and he will be able to take on this really super big task. The third illustration has to do with betrayal. And sometimes if your child is little right now, I see babies in arms and I'm like, you don't even know what I'm talking about. You'll be betrayed by your kids, and you'll be betrayed by your kids in really big ways and hurtful ways. And I want us to think about this because Jesus did something very special with Peter. He says, you will betray me, but I have prayed for you. And when you turn back, strengthen your brothers. And he says this to Peter in the same conversation. He's telling him that he's going to deny him three times. He says, and when you turn back, strengthen your brothers. What a wonderful vision to cast out there for Peter, that there was something good going to come out of this. And Peter did turn around, and he did strengthen his brothers. I have to say, this is one passage that I held on to when our son was in such great trouble, because it gave me the idea God could use this down the road with him. And so when Dan was in this great problem that he went through, it went on for years. It was not a short-term problem. It went on from the time he was a sophomore in high school till he was 29. And it involved just about anything you wouldn't want your kid to do. And in the middle of that time, well, kind of probably a third of the way through that time, my husband wrote a Bible verse on an index card. He wrote out 3 John verse 4. And the verse says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. There could have been nothing farther from reality at that point than Dan walking in the truth. And Wayne wrote it on this little index card, and he went over to play tennis with our son, and he gave it to him. And we, unbeknownst to us, Dan folded it in half, and he put it in his wallet that he carried every day. And for the next 10 years, or more than 10 years, he had that card in his wallet, and he saw it, he knew it was there. He knew his dad had a vision for him. And it meant the world to him. And when he turned around, and when he got sober, he pulled that card out of his wallet. It was, you know, practically threadbare. And he said, I've had this with me all this time. A vision can mean the world to a kid in trouble. And it did. I have a vision for my grandchildren, and they know it. And I always say to them, I don't care what you grow up to do for a job. I don't care where you end up living. I want you to be kind, tender-hearted, and forgiving one another as God in Christ has forgiven you. I've said this to them so many times, they all know it. I have a sign that I just bought on a trip. It's Be Kind. It's on my kitchen counter. And I think I want a character trait in them. I want to see them developed into kind, tender-hearted, forgiving people. And God has a way of working that into them. It's not because I'm going to work it into them, but I have confidence that God can work it into them. I have a confident vision for them because of who God is. Okay, my last point on that outline, that part of the outline is, we're going to use the model of how Jesus related to people and how God relates to us for this third point of an ongoing and eternal commitment through thick and thin. And again, when you've got a baby, and babies are the most beautiful thing in the world, you're working for the long haul here. You're working for the long term. And so thick and thin might mean something when you've got a baby. It might mean something different when you've got toddlers, something different when you've got school kids, and something different when you've got adult children. Thick and thin has a wide range, but this principle that we're going to see from how Jesus related is pretty sound. In his prayers, we're going to look at three different prayers that Jesus had for his people. The first prayer for the apostles, and this is an example of his prayer for the apostles. He knew them. He knew where the fault lines lay with his apostles. He spent time with them, and he recognized who they were. And so he could pray for them individually. And he says in this prayer from Luke 22, the same passage that I referenced earlier about Peter, he says, I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. What a great prayer for our kids, that as they come to faith, that we pray that your faith won't fail. The world's a tough place, and there are a lot of questions that come up. I pray that your faith won't fail. Another prayer that he had in John 17 is, and Jesus is praying to God his Father, my prayer is that you protect them from the evil one. What a great prayer for our kids. Not that they get through the day, or that they don't fall off the bus, or that, what if we prayed, and they heard us pray, and they knew we were praying for protection from the evil one. The third one is from John 17, Jesus was praying for all the believers. He says, I pray for all the believers, for those who believe in me through the gospel, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. What if our kids heard us praying that kind of prayer? Not that you'll quit fighting with your brother or your sister, but I pray that you'll be one. I pray that you'll have this feeling of unity that Jesus is praying for his believers. The other thing I stuck under this idea of this ongoing commitment. There's some images in the Bible of this ongoing commitment that I think are really strong, and I think we need to give our kids a wider picture than just our words. And just our words about theories or ideas, we need to give them some images to hang on to, especially young kids. In the Old Testament, there's an image that in Isaiah, which I love Isaiah, but there's an image in Isaiah of God as a nursing mother. And he says, this nursing mother may forget the child at her breast, but I won't forget you. And then he goes on in that passage in Isaiah, and he says, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. What a sense of, what a concrete image to have, that we are so important and our relationship with God is so important, that he loves us and he's more conscious of us than a nursing mother with a baby at her breast. And he has actually engraved our image on his hand. And in Jeremiah, he says, I've loved you with an everlasting love. And if you didn't get it, he goes on to say, if in a different translation says, I have always loved you and I always will. It doesn't hurt to repeat yourself when we're talking to our children about how much we love them. We can't say it enough. They don't hear it enough. And we can expand it. Go find some illustrations. Find some of the ways God talks to the people in the Bible and use those with your kids. I've always loved you and I always will. And in that same passage, if we think about the failures that we have sometimes in what we think of as how our children perform, the Israelite people failed in their relationship with the Lord God. And he says in that passage in Jeremiah 31, he says, I'll start over with you again. And he calls these people who have committed adultery, what God terms adultery, they'd gone after other countries and other gods. And he calls them back to himself. And this is the passage, I've loved you with an everlasting love. I've always loved you and I always will. And I'm going to start over with you again. And he renames them again. He says, dear virgin Israel. They were not virgin Israel. They were adulterous Israel, but he starts over and he does it so completely that he calls them my dear virgin Israel. And we have to be able to do that in our conversations with kids. We can't keep bringing up all the stuff from the past. We have to start over and we have to start fresh. In the New Testament, in John 14, Jesus is telling his disciples he's going to leave them. And they struggle with that. They've had this great relationship. And you think about how much we struggle with relationships that are ending if somebody's moving or our kids go off to college. But he says, I'm leaving you, but I'm going to come back for you. And then he says, I'll send another comforter. And he lays out this plan of how he's going to be relating to them when he leaves them. And I think we need to get that in our heads. Sometimes it's sending our kids to kindergarten. We stand and cry when our kids go to kindergarten. We stand and cry when they go to college. We stand and cry when they get married. And it always feels like they're leaving us. And yet, what we can have if we develop this relationship of intimacy with our kids carefully, we can have an ongoing relationship and be there with them. What does this look like with our kids? And I want to emphasize at this point that this relationship, this eternal security, this eternal relationship is something only God can give our kids. We cannot give our kids this kind of security. But we can display our commitment to the Lord as we care for our children. When they're little, we teach them to depend on God, not on us totally. They will have an eternal parent with them forever. We can teach them about our sin and how we need to be forgiven as we show them our sin and our asking for forgiveness, our humility, going to God, by admitting in front of them that we're wrong. If we have an issue with a spouse, they need to see us confess and repent and go back to our spouse. If we have a problem with them and we lose it, they need to hear us confess our sin, take responsibility, and come back. My daughter said, "Be sure to say this when you're talking about this." She said, because it was something that she says that she saw it with Wayne and me, that she saw us go back and confess our sin to each other, repent, and ask for forgiveness. I think we model for our kids more than we think we do. We model in our relationships. If I want to teach my children forgiveness or about their sin, their need for forgiveness, they need to see it in me. And we can pray with our children, age-appropriate prayers, but really big prayers. Big prayers. Not the little ones that we get stuck on, the details of daily living. Those are great. Kids need to know about trusting God with the little details, but we need to pray some of these really big prayers, and they need to hear us expressing our confidence in our prayers for God in their lives. We need to show our gratitude and our trust in God for their needs and for our needs. We need to show humility in our prayers. I know I can't do this, God, but I know that you can. One of the sources I used as I was thinking about doing this talk was talked about family stories that you share with your children. And it talked about the need for children to have stories that are repeated again and again from your family, that this is establishing children in their place and time and history. They feel part of a bigger community. They see their interactions. It's really important to repeat these stories over and over with children. And I'm not just young children, we're talking about all ages of children. So how do we do this with our children to display God's faithfulness in our families? I want to, that Joshua 4:20 passage is, I got a lot from Joshua this time, but Joshua was leading the people into the land out of the desert, out of their experience of 40 years in the desert. And they come up to the Jordan River. And the Jordan River parts, they get to walk through just like the Red Sea. And when they get through, Joshua sends a representative from each of the tribes back into the river to collect stones, like boulders, and out of the dry river. And he says, bring them out, stack them up. And they go, you know, why are we doing this? What's this about? And he says, in the future, when your descendants ask their fathers, what do these stones mean? Tell them that God did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God. When I was young, my grandfather loved the song, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. It's an old, old hymn. Does anybody even know that hymn? There's a verse in Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing that many people skip over. It's like the third verse or the fourth verse. And my grandfather used to sing this and belt it out, and I loved my grandfather, and I never knew what he was talking about. The verse starts out, here I raise my Ebenezer. And I thought when I was little, oh, that's so embarrassing. You know, I was sure it was his butt when he was, you know, when I was little. And I don't know why I thought that. I thought, what else could he be raising? And I'm thinking. But as he would sing it and as I got older, I thought, okay, well, it must be something significant. There must be something significant about an Ebenezer. I never found out until I was here after I started really study the Bible on my own, and I thought, now I've got tools. I'm going to go find out what an Ebenezer is. It's this pile of stones. It's this pile of stones that Joshua was talking about. I'm going to take these stones out of this dry river. It's going to go back to being a river, and there's going to be a pile of stones here. And when my kids trip over it, they'll say, "What's this pile of stones doing here?" And I'll say, "God did that so that we could come in to this land. He brought us here. He delivered us." So the song made more sense. Here I raise my pile of stones about God's faithfulness to deliver our family. So in my family, we had stories. And we shared these stories a lot from the time our family first started. And our family first started kind of in crisis in the 70s. I came back to Columbus to marry my husband. He had been widowed and had two little boys. When we got married, they were 2 and 5. It was a hard beginning. And I thought I could do just about anything. I couldn't do 2 and 5 boys. And then we had a girl a year later. And so then we had 3 kids. And I still was the most humbled I'd ever been in my life. I have so much respect for moms. I had no clue. I thought I'd had a dog, I'd had an apartment, I'd had a really big job. I could handle this. It was hard. And I was so humbled. And part of what our family story was how God put our family together in such a unique way. It still makes me cry. We all grew up together in the Lord. So we always had this as our story. God put us together in a really unique way. When we would say, "How many grandparents do we have?" We had more grandparents than anybody because we had all these grandparents. We had more great-grandparents than anybody, because who are all these people? This was Bill and Dan's first mom's grandpa and grandma, or Bill and Dan's first mom, and then I'm the second mom. And it became as part of our family story that one day Christina, our daughter, was sitting at the kitchen table, and she looked at me, and she was mad, and she was crying. And I said, "What are you crying about?" She always cried. And I said, "What are you crying about?" And she said, "How come Bill and Dan get 2 moms and I only get one?" And in her mind, that was such an advantage that they had over her. And again, that's part of our family story. So we told this story all the time in our family about how God did this special thing. Well, as it turned out, when Dan, our second kid, was getting married, his to-be wife found out that she could not have children, period. No children. She was never going to have children. And she came to my son and she said, "I don't know if you still want to marry me because I can't have children and I know you really want a family." And Dan used the same words that we had always used. And he said to her, "God puts families together. We'll have a family. And they have 2 beautiful little girls because God did something special for them. He put their family together." So that conversation, that story that we shared over and over in our family played out into Dan's life as an adult. Now it's part of their family story. And just quickly, one of their daughters was about, something I'd never even heard of before they did. And I'm in Cambodia and I'm sitting under a house, in a bamboo house, visiting a house church in Cambodia. And the people in that around that table, that they asked what they could pray for me. So I said, "You can pray," because I knew the next day in America, they were going to be trying this process. And I said, "You can pray for my grandchild." I thought, how can I explain embryo adoption to people in Cambodia who are living under a bamboo house? So I said, "Pray for my grandchild." And they said, "How old is your grandchild?" And I said, "Well, my grandchild's not born yet." And so they prayed for my grandchild, and the woman I was there with, the missionary I was visiting this church with, took a picture of this group praying for my grandchild. 9 months later, she was born. That picture is a part of her story, that there were people in Cambodia praying for her to grow in her mother's womb 9 months before she was born. These are important family stories to share and to keep going. Okay, we're shifting gears. we're going to go to the next page of practical ideas. This is group participation time. These are practical ideas. They're not the definitive list. And some of these ideas my kids pitched out. Some of the ideas are ones that I have shared with other parents and other parents have shared with me. But conversation is going to be the goal in all of these, and thinking about how you relate. They're not age specific, but they, you can adapt them for any, pretty much any age. Practical ideas to practice the skill of conversations. Practice in a low-risk environment. I think sometimes you practice with your friends, it's easier. I actually have a game I play sometimes when I'm traveling with somebody, and I did it with my mother-in-law one time for 8 hours in the car. We were moving them to Columbus, and I was alone with her in the car, and my husband was driving the truck with his dad, and I thought, how long can I keep her talking about herself? And it was a wonderful thing to do. She felt so loved. Every time she would talk about anything, I would say, well, then what happened? Who else was there? What did you guys find there when you went there? What did you think about that? How did you figure that out? I just kept asking her questions, and she fell asleep at one point. She slept, and she woke up and kept talking. It was wonderful. And I think sometimes with our kids, we just have time slots that work. But for that, you can practice this at any moment. The first point, the first practical idea is to be curious, and I had to pay for that input. I had to pay money to hear a counselor say to me, just be curious. You don't have to solve the problem. Just be curious about the issues. And it took off a lot of the weight in my conversations with my kids. I could be curious. I could wonder, how did you do that? What would you do differently the next time? How did you, who else was with you when that happened? What did they think when that happened? My daughter-in-law, Carrie, used to, from the time her child was an infant, from the time her child, her first child made eye contact and was babbling and would look into her face and would babble, 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 and then she would say, and then what happened? And it was so funny to see her doing it with an infant, but we all keep doing it now. In the middle of a conversation, one of the kids will be telling us something, or one of my kids will be telling me something, and it's amazing to see the reaction when you look at somebody and you say, and then what happened? There's always more to their story. And sometimes we cut them off. So, and then what happened? One of the articles that I read talked about setting appropriate consequences that you can pull your children into setting their own appropriate consequences, and I couldn't agree more. When we had our daughter, we put our two sons together in bunk beds. And the older son was on the top bunk, and the younger son was on the bottom bunk with the dog. And the older son found great pleasure in leaning over the top bunk and calling his younger brother's name. His younger brother worshipped him. He would stick his head out like this from the bottom bunk, and from the top bunk would come a spitball, and right on his face. And he did it again and again and again, and Dan would lean, have spitball on his face. And it didn't bother Dan as much as it bothered us. And we said, Bill, this is really not working so well with the bunk beds. How could we change this? What could we do? I mean, I didn't know what to do. He had to sleep in the bed. And he said, I could go to bed half an hour earlier, and then I'd be asleep when Dan came to bed. I would never have thought to put him in bed half an hour earlier. And it worked. He was asleep. Dan went to bed. He felt cool. And it worked, and pretty soon they were going back to bed at the same time. But for that moment, I never would have thought of it, and it worked. Asking somebody what they could do about the problem, a child of any age, whatever the problem is, what could you do about that? Who could you talk to about that? And my granddaughter Lauren was having some problems at school. And I'm a grandparent. I'm not even a parent. I'm not get called in on this at all. But she was talking to me about it, and I said, well, who could you talk to about that problem at school? And she made a whole list of people she could talk to about that problem at school. And she took responsibility, and she followed through on it. The second point is to be short, specific, and sincere, and patient. And I want to point out that the word patient from a biblical point of view does not mean waiting for a train patient. It means withholding judgment. It means that I can listen without answering back on whatever my child is telling me, whatever my friend is telling me. I don't have to correct. I don't have to be there with an answer. It means I can listen and I can ask questions. I can keep the conversation going. I don't have to solve the problem. And this can happen through games. I have always played with our kids a game, some cards that I had from a game in the 60s or 70s called the Ungame, and it was just like questions. But these I got for my kids, and they're just cards they pull out at the dinner table, and they read a question. What's the best birthday party you can imagine? And then people talk about what's the best birthday party you can imagine. They go around the table, and they play it with me when I'm there, which is really nice because I get to be part of it. One of the questions that they pulled, some of the questions are more adult kind of questions, so you can edit the questions. But for any kind of game, there are lots of games like this out there. But one time we were at dinner, and the question was, what would you stand up for? And I think from an adult point of view, it would be a political thing or a faith thing. But for my grandson, he said, my friends, I'd stand up for my friends if they were getting bullied. And we're like, hey, yes, you know, do that. Stand up for your friends. So questions like that as conversation starters are not cheating. Actually, it's really a good tool. They also play, my kids play a game with their kids called Highs and Lows. And at the table, they go around and they say, what was the best part of their day and what was the worst part of their day? And they share that with each other. Again, these are short, and you're talking, for my kids, you're talking about young elementary kids. So these are short conversations, but they show a lot of respect. They show a lot of exchange. One of the articles I was reading as I was looking at this said that rituals are important to children. They help provide security and structure, and they give a sense of belonging. And later in that article, the writer said, but this means turning off electronics. Turning off my electronics, turning off their electronics. There has to be some basket over there someplace where everybody parks their stuff. Again, if you've got babies in arms, you don't have stuff for them. But I've seen moms at the park on the cell phone with their kids. And the kids are wanting attention, and the mom's talking on the phone. And I don't know how many important conversations there would have to be at the park. I understand that there are important conversations, but when you've got time with your kids, don't throw it away. It's going to go fast. I can attest to that. Books. There are lots of books. I brought some books that I had, and I only brought them, not because, I mean, I'm sure they're not even published anymore, but I kept these from the time with my kids. They're ragged, haggard, and torn, and I've written in them. If you own books, write in them. Write in your children's Bibles as they give you their ideas about what they're thinking. Write in books. I have blank books that I carry with me when I see my grandkids, and I did this with my kids too. And they can write in it, they can draw in it, they love to draw their handprints. There are all kinds of handprints in here, but I write down their words, and it's a way of valuing what children say. And often children don't feel, and lost in the shuffle, don't feel valued, and they don't feel heard. I forget where I am on this outline. Car time. If you've got an iPhone, use it for pictures, and then share the pictures with the kids repeatedly, and put your stories in with those pictures. My grandkids love, my kids say, your phone's not a photo album, but to me it is. And when I'm with my grandchildren, they know that I will talk to them as long as they want to talk about what happened on that day when that picture was taken, or who was with us on that day, or what we were doing, or what we were thinking. What, we want to do it again? No, maybe not, but that was fun that day, or let's go do it again soon. And I think you build some continuity. It's an image that kids can grab a hold of. I went to visit my pseudo-grandson. I have a kind of an adopted daughter, and she has a son who's 18 months old. And I went to visit him in February, and I visited the mom too, but I really went to see Bennett. And she said, oh, he won't sit still for anything. He's just so active, and he's big and active. And I said, let me show him the pictures. I took pictures of him. I said, let me show him his pictures on my phone. Oh, she said, he'll never sit still for that. Well, the last morning I was there, I got him up. She slept, and I got him up, and I brought him in bed with me. And he looked at pictures on my phone for an hour in bed with me. And he's 18 months old, and I wear this necklace all the time, and it's connected. It's a story. I have a story with the necklace because it's about his mom. And so I took it off, and I put it on him, and I took a picture of him. And he loved that picture of him wearing this necklace. And now she sends me pictures. He'll make necklaces out of stuff, and he'll wear them. But my point with that is kids love this. They love to see pictures of their dishes in the dishwasher. They love to see pictures of themselves on the swings. And you can always work into that. Your conversation, your goal would be to have that conversation with them, to establish hope and a vision, to express how you're with them and a commitment to them over the long haul. Okay, some of the rest of the stuff, I don't know, car time is really great. Take risks and make a mess. My daughter says, don't get mad, take pictures. And she has done this. We've just spent time at Old Man's Cave last week with her daughter, who's just turned 6, and they all fell in the water, and it was before the warm weather came, and they were freezing, and their feet were wet. And I'm like, was that a really good idea? And she's like, they'll remember it. They'll remember what they did, and they will. And we took pictures, and now we still already talked about them. Take risk, make mess. I want to just hit the part there where I've got older kids and boys of certain age. Some of you are raising boys or older kids. And I want to really make a plug for neutral territory and neutral space, and also an end point in sight. This is really important, I think, for kids who get nervous about conversations. They don't want to be roped in. So it's not necessary to have eye contact to have good conversation. You can have what kids, you think of parallel play at a certain age with little kids, and it really actually is pretty important with older kids too, to have kind of a parallel existence. Diner stools are great for this because you sit beside each other, you don't look at each other. Sitting on a bench in my front yard, I have a bench that's like, the kids tease me, they're gonna put up the peanut sign that says open, and people come sit on that bench and we look out at the street together and people talk. It's amazing. We don't have to look at each other. Especially with older kids, there needs to be an escape plan. It needs to be like, let's have breakfast before, we'll go out to breakfast before I take you to school. And they know that you're not going to get them late to school. So they know that if you go to breakfast, they're only going to have to talk to you for a short time. And it really does loosen the strings on conversation. And be active. Nothing's better than sweating up a kid and then kind of collapsing with something cold to drink on the ground and having a real conversation. It really does make a difference to have lots of large motor stuff, hit all the metro parks in the summer, or go to the big library downtown where there's lots of space to run around, or ride bikes, whatever big motor stuff you can do. And then that downtime at the end is really valuable. Always have food with older kids. Always have food. My kids played basketball, my boys played basketball in the driveway with friends from school or friends from their home churches, and I would stand in the kitchen and bake cookies. They thought, they loved it. They thought they were getting away with something when they would come through the kitchen and grab raw cookie dough, and I would always go, don't eat it, there are raw eggs in there. And it was a game we played ourselves. They knew they were getting something, they thought they were getting away with something, and I knew without a shadow of a doubt that I was the winner. I got to have them talking to me, joking with me, laughing with me, building something with me that was going to pay off. So Alex Steinman was one of the kids that would run through my kitchen and eat cookie dough. And a couple years ago, he asked me to make cookies for the Harambe staff dinner. And he made a joke about it because all those years he'd run through my kitchen and eaten cookie dough, raw cookie dough, and snitched cookies when they were done, took them right off the tray, hot. Got away with that. Yeah, he did get away with that. And I got away with having a relationship with him. The last point is I just want to have us be committed to conversations. This week in the paper, Margaret Thatcher had died, and somebody had a line about her that I really stole just for today. And it said that Margaret Thatcher mixed conviction with the long view. And I really think that's what we need to do with our kids. We need to mix conviction. I want a relationship with you. I'm going to take risks. I'm going to look for the long view, though. I'm not going to demand it all to happen today. So I just encourage you with that idea that of Margaret Thatcher's. It's like panning for gold. You're going to stand there for a long time and sift these what look like common stones, and you're going to get nuggets out of it. My last thing I want to leave us with is the idea that a point of truth, that God does this with us in the most extraordinary ways. He wants an intimate relationship with us. And as I understand how God initiated with me, he came out and got me when I was unlovable, when I was a mess. He came and found me, and he invited me into this eternal relationship with him through Jesus Christ, his son. He clothed me in new clothes. He washed me of everything that was wrong with me, and he set me in a high place in a relationship with him. And he showed me that he had the power to do all of this through the death and resurrection of his son, just what we celebrated at Easter. So as I entered this new relationship with God through Christ, I am totally freed of all my past mistakes, all my past sins, all my past failures, and I am empowered to practice this new intimate relationship with the Lord, and it is good. I want to communicate that to you as much as I want to communicate it to my kids. This is good. I am empowered to practice this relationship with God himself and with the people in my life. I can be free to try things and to fail, and I can be free to come back to God. And if you have not come to this point of knowing this kind of a relationship with God, who is the model for this kind of intimate relationships with our children and with our families, I urge you to make that decision to go to God, thank him for giving you this opportunity, to this great invitation. Have a conversation with God. And thank him that he has come out to get you and to bring you home. And then thank him for giving you a new name, a new position. Thank you for allowing you to call him Papa or Daddy. And begin to walk in his spirit with him in newness of life. And enjoy this new intimate relationship. And let that be part of your story that you share with your children and that you share with your families. And let that be part of the life that you're going to live. So I thank you for letting me talk. I love to talk. I'd love to talk with you more. And we have time for feedback, questions, or comments on any of this. And I hope that you've got some great ideas. Yeah.
I just thank you for your joyful approach on this subject.
Well, you're welcome. I totally love to be able to share what God has done in my family. It's my family, if anything could have gone wrong, it did, and yet here we are still talking to each other and walking together. So it's really a testimony to who God is. Anything else? Yeah.
I appreciate you also being transparent with us and sharing with us the struggles you've also had in your family life, because now that my daughter is entering into this teenage years,
bless you.
Yeah, when you say children can betray you, yes, I understand. And it gives me such a great long-term view of what my children still can do with their lives and deepen their walk with the Lord. And it's such a, like, almost liberating. It's great to hear. Yes, they may fail and they may struggle, but this is just the process. So that was like, that's very liberating for me. And then the one other thing I did want to share is that, you know, I tend to volunteer to drive the kids everywhere.
It's a great plan.
It is the best because the girls somehow think that you're invisible when
they
you're
do.
Driving.
They do.
And they start talking about things that you wouldn't otherwise get a glimpse of.
Absolutely.
And sometimes I want to scream because what they're sharing is like, huh, really? This is what the kind of stuff you guys talk about? But when you say withhold judgment,
yes.
Oh my gosh, that is probably the most challenging thing. But I get a really good glimpse of the conversations that they're having with one another, what's relevant in their lives, mm-hmm. and it's giving me an opportunity to kind of go back to my daughter later yeah. on and share or talk and pray about it. So I just thought everything you talked about is definitely relevant. Thank you. It's inspiring.
Well, and I thank you for sharing. That was one of my daughter's things that she talked about was driving. And I drove how many boys' trips to Cedar Point, which is like, did I ever want to go to Cedar Point with a bunch of teenage boys? No. But it was the car time was unbelievably valuable. You're right. Anybody else? Yeah.
I've heard some people say that's a non-negotiable, that, you know, we have this Bible study at a certain time, and my kids are more like, I've got a daughter that's on and off about wanting to do that with me, and I kind of introduce it, then back off from it. I mean, do you have any advice about that? Or
I think it's a really important thing to consider who the child is, because if a child is on and off and back and forth, the last thing I would recommend would be forcing that child into Bible study. I have, among my children, and I was, a child of the 60s, and I was truly a hippie. I don't go a lot of, I'm free form. So even for a child that's really open and receptive, I much more enjoy talking with that child, reading. There's a brand new, Zondervan has a brand new children's Bible. It's really, really a good children's Bible. I meant to bring it, I forgot. I'm much more likely to take an opportunity with a child who's ready and open and willing, not at a set time, not a set Bible study, not a set prescription, but to take that child who's ready and then run with it as far as I can. And then if it dries up, I can wait. I think I can always pray. I always prayed with our kids. Even if they didn't want to pray, I could pray. And I didn't expect them to always want to pray. From my perspective, it's much more, I got much more distance out of responding to the child's readiness or willingness than prescribing something. So, and I think we're free to do what the child needs. What the child's needs are. Our kid who rebelled, I wouldn't have. I lost hope so many times that anything we'd ever said or done had ever sunk in, and yet he pulled that verse out of his pocket, and it was startling. It was like God's slap upside the face, saying, "I did this. I did this. I gave him hope." And it was really remarkable. So I think don't ever think that anything you're throwing out there is necessarily wasted. I think you do what God leads you to do with the child. Yeah. Yes.
Hi. Oh, thank you for teaching. I got a question, though. I have a stepdaughter mm-hmm. and my little son. Is it wrong that I share more of my heart with my son than my stepdaughter?
Is that wrong?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that. I think one of the issues about step families is that I don't know where you are in the process of blending your families, or I don't know what ages you're talking about. But I would urge you to take a risk and be as open and be as vulnerable with your stepchildren as with your blood children. And I think that's how God does accomplish something, is if as you can take a risk, as you can forfeit your security for that sake of that conversation, to share your emotional life and to share your vulnerability and with both of your children. As it's appropriate age-wise. I think there are a lot of questions there in your question, but I think as you can do it, it's going to make that intimacy, it's going to establish the intimacy that you, I think, want to have in your family. sometimes we're busy protecting ourselves as parents, and that doesn't go really far in establishing intimacy.
You made some references to the way your husband related to his kids, but I was just wondering, is there a different dynamic between moms and their kids versus dads and their kids, and what maybe to expect, or
I think there's a huge difference, and there's a huge difference personality-wise. My husband was as far opposite me conversationally as he could be, and then we had the male-female thing going. And I think it's really important to recognize there's a huge difference in personalities, there's a huge difference in roles as a father and a mother. But and I think both are really pretty essential. I got impatient at times, and I wanted my husband to do more of what I thought he should be doing, and I told him so, and that didn't get me very far. And what happened was, again, God would surprise me by some of the things. Wayne wouldn't talk and wouldn't talk and wouldn't talk and wouldn't talk and wouldn't talk, but when he talked, our kids didn't have the aversion. They'd heard me talking endlessly, and sometimes I just rolled off their back, whatever I said. Wayne could come out with a pop, and it really held, and it really counted. So I urge, as much as we need to look at the differences in our kids' personalities and our kids' ages and our kids' development and maturity, we need to look at that within the spousal relationships and recognize their differences, and that God uses all of it. He uses all of it. And I can only go back and point you to that index card that my son carried for more than 10 years. I told him I was going to share that story, and he said, oh, I finally put my wallet through the wash. And he said, I pulled my wallet out, and he said, the thing I was most worried about was that index card. He was still carrying it. Now he's 43, and he still was carrying that poor little index card. So I would never undersell different styles of conversation or approaches.
I had a question about teenage boys.
My favorite.
Just help us to address expectations. You know, when you ask questions, they're like one answer words, and then or they'll be like, I don't know, you know. And so it's so frustrating because it seems like, you know, it's so hard to talk to them.
It's very hard to talk to teenage boys. It has to be at the moment they want something. I do believe. So it's when we go back to panning for gold, it's like you have to be patient until the desire is there. And often, I can say, I thought of two recent experiences I've had with teenage boys. One, a pre-adolescent, or preteen boy, but just getting there. And his mom had me taking him to dinner and delivering him to his study group because she was getting married. So I took him to dinner, it was the night before the wedding. So I took him to dinner at Panera, where we sat on my thing with teenage boys. You don't sit across from each other, you sit side by side. So we sat side by side at Chipotle, I guess it was Chipotle, looking out the window at High Street. And he started eating, and there wasn't any conversation. And, you know, do you need something else to drink? And nope, nothing. All of a sudden he started talking, and what he really wanted was, he wanted me to take him back to his house before his boy's cell group so he could wash his hair. But he didn't want to say that, so he was asking me all these things like, can we get out of here? I'm done eating, can you take me to your house? And I'm like, that's kind of out of the way, you know. And so we started talking about, what do you need at my house? And he's like, my hair doesn't look good and I'm like, really? And so it was such a cool exchange because I got to be the hero and he got to know that I would take him where he needed to go. And when he couldn't get in his house, we ended up going to my house. He ended up washing his hair in my sink. And but it was so cool because he needed something. And out of that, we made kind of another tight link, another tight bond. And we actually, on the way back to the group, we actually had a significant conversation. So I think you look for there's nothing wrong with being the slave to the kid if you're going to get something out of it. They think they win, you think you win. The other one I thought about with after my daughter said, talk about boys, a kid who was the son of a good friend, and he was on his way. He knew he was going to go to Marysville, to the correctional facility at Marysville for some pretty serious things he had done. And he needed a pair of shoes. And I was at Kroger, and I got a phone call from him. And he said, where's that place on Lane Avenue to get running shoes? So I told him where it was, and I mean, it was like he'd never heard of Lane Avenue before. He just wanted to keep talking. And so I said, well, I'm at Kroger, why don't I just meet you there? And so I met him, and it was really odd because he'd never done anything like this before, called me like that. I mean, I'd made overtures to him, but he'd never called me like that. And so then after he got the I met him, he got the shoes he wanted. They were cool shoes, and we talked about how cool they were and how big they were, and gosh, these are really big shoes. And we went, I said, there's a coffee place right across the street. Let's go get coffee. Do you have time? And he's like, sure. So we drive across the street, get out, sit next to each other outside, looking out at the OSU field, and we had a conversation for an hour and a half. Totally led by him, totally talking about what his girlfriend was doing and how he'd miss his girlfriend, and his mom had died some years before, and how, what would she think about him going into the to correctional facility. He talked about how he'd hurt his family and all of this, but it's like, man, I had a lot of years in there that were pretty slow years before I got to that conversation. So I do think there are conversations that guys want to have. It's just being patient and setting the scene and letting them call some shots, have some control, and looking for the need, you know, and take advantage of it. I do think going with teenage boys, it really has to be, and I think it's a good thing to recognize they need some control of conversation. And so I had to back down and put down what I wanted out of the conversations and be willing to take sometimes what I got. Anything else? Yeah.
So I have a question. What if your child, not necessarily moral issues, but so I have a son that likes to share things with me, but then he's like, don't tell dad, just because they're like personal, like about girls or whatever.
Right.
Is that, I mean, it's not really a moral thing, but I don't want it to be like we're in cahoots against his dad. Do you know what I mean?
Right, I do know what you mean. And I would just, when you have this, when it's not a life or death kind of thing and you're trying to build a trust relationship, I think it's okay to say this, you know, I hear you saying you don't want me to share this. I think your dad would love to know this, or your dad would, and I think as long as you're building toward that, I think it's really good. I think it's a way of saying in our family we don't keep secrets, in our family we, you know, dad might have some really good input, that would make dad really happy. You know, let's figure out what you could tell dad about that. So I think you don't want to build, I don't ever think you want to divide yourself. One of my points that I wanted to make in this talk at some point, and this is the perfect time to do it, is to protect your marriage, that your children need a relationship with you, but they really need to have your marriage intact. They need to see that you respect your husband. They need to see that you don't keep secrets. So I think you keep building toward that, even if a child has asked you not to say whatever it is to the parent. And I think there's some things that you share with a parent, even if a child has said, I don't want my other parent to know this, because I think you do need to protect and always be building with your spouse. Anything else? I want to put my one plug in for sex, since I've got 5 minutes. conversations about sex in marriage with your kids. I feel like, and it's probably relating to the boy question as well, and especially, and also teenage girls, our children need to know that there is a place for great sex. If we spend our lives telling our kids, don't have sex, don't get involved with sex, don't go to movies where sex is explicit, don't be getting too close to that boyfriend in high school, when you go to college, I'm really worried you're going to have sex. I mean, all we do is say all the negative stuff about sex. We have short-sold our kids unless they know that in marriage you have great sex. And so I think I'm going to put a plug in, which I always do whenever I can, to demonstrate to your children the enjoyment and the appropriate enjoyment of sexual relationship with your spouse. They won't get it in the world. And Annette's sitting here, but I mentored when Annette and I, was leading some junior high kids and high, then eventually high school kids in the after-school program at Urban Concern. I would drive those kids and be with those kids, those girls. And one of the girls, we talked about sex in the car, back to the car, and so they were appalled that I'd only ever had sex with one person. They were like, what? Are you kidding? That's so boring. Don't you get tired of each other? What are you missing? Do you ever wonder what it would have been like? And so I had a chance in the car more than once to say to those girls, this is what God's plan is, and it's a really good plan. My kids, I went to a wedding with one of my daughter's friends, and it was after Wayne died, and we were sitting at round tables like this, and I ended up sitting with a bunch of the girls that they'd gone to high school together, and they all talked about how I'd talked to them in the kitchen baking cookies about sex when they were in high school. It was so funny. We're sitting at this wedding, and they're all about getting to be 30 years old, and we're talking about those conversations over baking cookies about sex. So I urge you to have that in your arsenal, and if you can't figure out how to have the conversations about sex with your kids, talk to some other women, figure out ways to introduce the topic and bring the topic up, and to encourage kids with the idea of what God's plan is for their sexuality.